Welcome to Attack the System Radio, a program dedicated to pan-anarchism against the state and pan-secessionism against the empire, with Keith Preston. Politicians hide themselves away. They only started the war. Why should they go out to fight? They leave their all to the poor. Yeah.
Welcome to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, coming to you from attackthesystem.com. This is being recorded on December the 8th, 2013. And tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about something that I've written a fair amount about over the years, and I've done other programs on issues related to this. This is something I really wanted to get into some serious detail on this particular program, and that's the question of the growth of the police state in the United States in recent decades. And I want to go back and trace how that police state really began to develop, because it's a really interesting story. It's an unfortunate story, but it is one that many people really are not particularly familiar with, or may only be familiar with bits and pieces of it. So I want to go back and talk about how several different things really have intersected, several different historical currents have intersected in order to make the contemporary American police state what it actually is. On the radical left, there's this concept called intersectionality. Intersectionality, and it's for those who are not familiar with that term, it's basically intersection, like an intersection on the street. Intersectionality, with the ality added at the end. It's a term that radical leftists use to suggest that all forms of what they consider to be oppression are somehow interconnected with each other. And if you spend a lot of time around these people, you'll hear them talk about that a lot, about how racism and sexism and homophobia and transphobia and speciesism and ageism and classism and ethnocentrism and all these other things are intersected with one another. Now, I do think that in that particular context, some of those claims are exaggerated from time to time, maybe not wholly untrue, but certainly exaggerated. But I do think that this wider concept of intersectionality does have some legitimacy, because it is true that there are various political and cultural and historic currents that do converge with one another to create modern systems of oppression. And when I say oppression, I don't mean oppression in the sense that some people can't have their way, or that some people don't always get what they want and things like that. I'm talking about genuine systems of highly authoritarian political rule that have genuinely damaging, severely damaging impacts on the lives of a whole lot of people, and create severe political obstacles in the process. And I'll get into that in a little bit. But I want to talk about on this broadcast about how three different types of currents really interact with one another to create the modern police state. One of them is drug prohibition, which libertarians have spent a lot of time over the years criticizing that. The other one is the wider growth of the police state apparatus itself, that is, the efforts by the state to strengthen its systems of legal and police control over the past few decades. And the third one is, of course, what I call totalitarian humanism. And for those who aren't familiar with my use of that term, it's a term I use to describe authoritarian progressivism, the idea that the state must interfere in every area of life, in every area of society, in every contending power center, in every institution, in order to enforce so-called progressive values. I see all of these things beginning to converge, and well, it's not just beginning, they have converged in contemporary societies, particularly in the United States, I believe, to some degree in other parts of the Western world, in various ways, in various forms, depending on the place. But I do think that we see these three things interacting quite a bit, or intersecting quite a bit: drug prohibition, the police state, and totalitarian humanism. Now, how did this come about? How did this come about, and what do I mean by all this? The first part of this is drug prohibition. Drug prohibition, of course, is the system whereby the state singles out particular types of drugs for criminalization, for the criminalization of their use or distribution, usually psychoactive substances, but not necessarily all psychoactive substances. For example, in contemporary American society, psychoactive substances like alcohol, tranquilizers, things like Prozac, Ritalin, which is a stimulant, certainly caffeine, tobacco products, all of those things are considered legal, to use them as legal, to sell them as legal. Doctors may prescribe them in some cases. But there are other psychoactive substances like marijuana, hashish, LSD, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, and so forth, that are considered illegal. And if you possess or use those, you can be subject to arrest, incarceration. If you are caught selling any of these things, you can be subject to very severe criminal penalties that are comparable to what people who are convicted of serious common crimes like robbery, rape, and murder are subjected to. And one thing that is particularly interesting when we look at this phenomenon of drug prohibition, and one of the most incongruous things about drug prohibition, is the fact that some drugs, some psychoactive drugs, are legal, even considered to have medical usage, even considered socially acceptable, whereas other drugs that have a very similar effect in many ways, or whose effects are certainly just as potentially hazardous to a user, are considered serious crimes against the state. And they have to ask this question: why is that? Why is it that it's perfectly legal and acceptable to use or sell alcoholic beverages or prescription tranquilizers or tobacco products, but not marijuana and not cocaine? And of course, to look at that, we have to go back a bit in American history, and probably the very best book ever written on that subject was a book by a man named David Musto. Back in the early 70s, he published a book called An American Disease, The Origins of Narcotics Control. And what he meant by this, what this writer David Musto meant, he was a recognized expert on drug policy. He wasn't particularly ideological. He was more of just a social scientist type, policy wonk or whatever. He never really had strongly expressed opinions on drug policy. But one thing that David Musto gathered from his research, and he did this in a very detached, very non-ideological way, as I said, is that the entire history of drug prohibition in the United States, which goes back to the late 19th, early 20th century, was largely set up for the purpose of controlling populations that those in power at the particular time wanted to see controlled. And of course, one thing that immediately enters into that is ethnic groups. And you can go back and see transcripts of debates that occurred in Congress, and people in libertarian movements that are staunch critics of drug prohibition have pointed this out. If you can consult their websites and books and writings and so forth, if you want to verify this. But it was widely recognized that things like marijuana were popular among Mexicans, that opium was popular among Chinese, that Cocaine was believed to be popular among blacks, and generally speaking, these drugs were drugs that were associated with people that were considered disreputable or socially on the margins and things like that. And David Mousteau, in his research, gathered quite a bit of evidence to show that public hysteria about drugs and political crusades against drugs tend to happen at precisely the same time that unpopular political or cultural groups are seen to be using particular drugs. For instance, back during the era of alcohol prohibition, which is in the 1920s, it was also called the jazz age or the roaring 20s or whatever. And back then, when jazz music was starting to become popular, you start seeing a lot of people getting upset that these jazz musicians who were, you know, disreputable people, they play in these sleazy bars and brothels and all kinds of places, and you know, a lot of them are black people. A lot of people start getting upset that jazz musicians may be smoking marijuana or using cocaine or heroin or something like that. And you see the same thing a few decades later in the 1960s when you see people getting upset that some of these dirty hippies might be smoking pot or some of these inner city black folks might be using heroin or whatever. And if you look at the entire history of drug prohibition in the United States, you see that drug prohibition tends to escalate at precisely the same time that some particular outgroup is targeted by the state, and that these particular drugs are identified with this particular outgroup. That's a very consistent pattern in American history, and David Mousteau documented that very well in his research. Now, another thing that's interesting, and this is another point that David Mousteau also raised, and that was that the structure of international narcotics prohibition, that is, drug laws that are set up at the international level through international treaties and international organizations, are also largely the creation of the United States. It was the United States back in the early 20th century, the early to middle 20th century, when the United States was first becoming a major world power. It was really the United States that pushed the enactment of much of the structure of international drug prohibition that we have at present. And that's why David Mousteau called his landmark book An American Disease on the Origins of Narcotics Control. He basically argued that domestic American drug prohibition was largely set up for the purpose of controlling undesirable social groups, particularly ethnic groups during that time, and that the structure of international drug prohibition was largely due to American influence in the realm of foreign policy as well. And that's what he means when he called drug prohibition an American disease. By the way, David Mousteau was not a gung-ho libertarian who was a staunch proponent of repealing drug laws and things like that. He was simply a social scientist. He rarely took any outspoken position on drug policy. He wasn't formally for or against things like drug legalization. He just simply approached this from a scientific perspective, from a historian's perspective, and so forth. And this is the conclusion that he came to. So we see that the structure of drug prohibition begins with efforts by the American state to persecute social groups, demographic groups, and so forth that it wants to relegate to the margins of society, and using its international influence to set up the structure of modern drug prohibition as well. And that's really the first phase of the so-called war on drugs, these things that were set up in the early to middle 20th century that David Mousteau wrote about and documented very thoroughly. Now, the second wave of the war on drugs begins around the year 1970. And what was unique about that was that the regime of Richard M. Nixon had recently taken power, and that one of Richard Nixon's top associates, one of his top, you can say henchmen or, you know, top aides, however you want to describe it, was a fellow by the name of John Ehrlichman. And John Ehrlichman was one of the principal figures in the Watergate scandal that happened a few years ago. And I mean, a few years later, a few years after Nixon took office. And Ehrlichman ended up in federal prison for his role in the Watergate scandal. But in the early years of the Nixon administration, Richard Nixon took office in 1969, and it was around this time that the Nixon administration began doing things like compiling an enemies list, engineering political trials of dissidents and so forth. J. Edgar Hoover was still alive at this point, and he had the COINTELPRO program running through the FBI, whose purpose was to crush internal dissident movements in the United States. And, of course, this is 1969, 1970, when protest movements are at their peak because of the Vietnam War and things like that. And John Ehrlichman, many years after leaving the White House, after leaving the Nixon administration, after leaving prison, gave an interview to a man by the name of Daniel Baum. Daniel Baum was a left liberal writer. He used to write for The Nation magazine. He wrote a book on drug prohibition some years ago called Smoke and Mirrors. It's probably still around. You can probably find a copy of it on Amazon.com or probably even in a university library or something like that. But John Ehrlichman, one of Richard Nixon's top henchmen, gave an interview to Daniel Baum where he said that when the Nixon regime was in power, they regarded themselves as having two primary enemies, two primary political enemies. One was the anti-war movement that opposed Nixon's war policy in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos. And the other one was black people, because the this is when the Black Power movement was at its peak, and you had groups like the Black Panthers and that sort of thing. And John Ehrlichman said that they knew that they couldn't legally simply make it illegal to be against the war or to be black. So they decided that one of the things they would do is they would try to wage a crusade against drugs, and they would use the war on drugs as a smokescreen for attacking political and demographic groups that they saw as political opponents. And this was really the beginning of the modern war on drugs. It was Richard Nixon himself who coined the term war on drugs around 1970. Now, there's a man by the name of Jack Cole. Jack Cole is a retired New Jersey State police officer, and he is now head of an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. It's basically an organization of people on the enforcement side who are opposed to the war on drugs. That is, policemen, judges, prosecutors, people of that type, prison wardens, and so forth. And Jack Cole was a narcotics agent for the New Jersey State Police right at the very beginning of the war on drugs in 1970. And he was a true believer in this. He talks about how he probably sent thousands of younger people from that generation, maybe, you know, mostly hippie types, to jail for smoking marijuana and things like that. And he was right there at the beginning of the war on drugs, and he said that in the space of about a year, the war on drugs expanded dramatically, where money started pouring in to local and state law enforcement agencies from the federal government for the purpose of waging the war on drugs. And law enforcement organizations, of course, scrambled to start getting some of this federal money, and you started seeing the narcotics division of police forces expanding dramatically, and more narcotics agents going undercover and things like this. And he was one of these people. This is Jack Cole, who's now head of an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. But this is the outgrowth of the Nixon administration's war on drugs that was set up for the purpose of attacking political opponents, which, as I said, during that time was obviously black people and the anti-war movement. What they wanted to do was associate marijuana with the anti-war movement and with hippies and the counterculture and so forth, as well as the other mind drugs, LSD and psilocybin mushrooms and that kind of stuff. And they wanted to associate the other drugs, cocaine and heroin and all that, with black people, with inner city black people. And so that was the beginning of the war on drugs. It was the Nixon administration's effort to wage war on the counterculture, on the anti-war movement, and on the urban black insurgency by under the cover of the war on drugs, under the legal and political cover of the war on drugs. This has been thoroughly documented, and it has been admitted to by some of its architects, like John Ehrlichman. Now, it's also during the same time that we see a brand new development in the history of American law enforcement, and that is the growth of paramilitary SWAT teams. That was something that came about around 1969, 1970. I think the first SWAT team was created in Los Angeles during that time by Daryl Gates. Daryl Gates was the chief of police in Los Angeles for quite some time, probably at least 20-some years. He was the chief of police back during the era of the Rodney King incident back in the early 90s. And it was Daryl Gates who really helped to develop the modern SWAT team system, the modern system of paramilitary policing. And the reason that SWAT teams were cultivated was for the purpose ostensibly of quelling civil unrest. Keep in mind, this is the late 60s, early 70s. You've got anti-war uprisings on campuses. You've got the race riots in the inner cities and so forth. And SWAT teams were set up for the purpose of trying to repress these things. There was a television series on back in the mid-1970s. I used to watch it when I was a kid, called SWAT. It was simply about SWAT teams, which were a brand new phenomena back then. At the time, it was actually considered the most violent television program ever in the history of television. Now, that, keep in mind, this is about 1974, so there's probably been a whole lot that's worse since then. But I do remember watching that show, and it was an extremely violent show. Just about every episode, you'd see a SWAT guys chasing down somebody and shooting them. That's about all they ever did. But this is when SWAT teams started to emerge in response to the uprisings of the late 60s and early 70s. It was also during this time that the federal government developed a program called Operation Garden Plot. I'm not advancing conspiracy theories here. All of this stuff is well documented. It's been admitted to by many of its principal architects. You can find plenty of information about this from reputable journalistic sources and historians and so forth. But Operation Garden Plot was developed in the early 70s for the purpose of essentially protecting the government in the case of severe civil unrest. And that gets to some other questions that I want to examine in this program. For example, one of those is this thing that I call totalitarian humanism. I'm actually going to explain a little bit how the police state and totalitarian humanism intersect. But it's with this system of drug prohibition that was initially created back in the early 20th century. It was strengthened dramatically during the era of Richard Nixon. And during the same era, you see things like the creation of paramilitary SWAT teams. You also see Operation Garden Plot formulated by the federal government, which is basically a system whose purpose is to impose martial law in the event of a severe civil unrest or an insurrection or something like that. And that gets to what I think has been the primary strategy of the power elite in American society over the past 40 years. I think that much of what has happened in American society since the early 70s can be explained in terms of some of the things I'm going to review in this program. What's particularly interesting about the developments that have happened in American politics over the past 40 years is that on one hand, the culture itself has become much more open, much more pluralistic, much more diverse, much more fluid in many ways. And of course, I've covered that in the past, and it's not anything that's controversial. I mean, we all know, we can look around and see, we can read history books and know that society has become much more liberal regarding things like race, gender, sexuality, gay rights, abortion rights, a wide assortment of social issues, everything from consumer safety to environmentalism to animal rights and many other things. And the realm of individual privacy rights in some areas has been expanded. For example, censorship laws have been relaxed. Restrictions on things like birth control and things like that have been relaxed quite a bit in the last 40 or so years compared to what they were before. At the same time, we also see during that exact same period of time a dramatic rise in the police state. We see not only the growth of the war on drugs and things like SWAT teams and Operation Garden Plot and all that, but we see the militarization of law enforcement in a much more generalized way. And of course, all of that overlaps with the continued expansion of the war on drugs. The war on drugs began with Nixon in the early 70s. It was escalated by the Reagan administration in the 1980s. What's interesting is that it was during the era of Bill Clinton in the 1990s. Bill Clinton, who was something of a boogeyman to conservatives. I know when he was president, conservatives seemed to hate his guts. But ironically, Bill Clinton expanded the police state rather dramatically beyond what his predecessors like Ronald Reagan, like George W. Bush, like Richard Nixon had done. And in the 1990s, the war on drugs of Presidents Nixon and President Reagan turned into full-blown wars on crime, guns, gangs, all sorts of things during the era of Bill Clinton. Now, it wasn't just Bill Clinton by himself. I mean, for example, there was a Republican-controlled Congress during much of the 1990s who started enacting a lot of draconian legislation concerning drugs, crime, and many things like that. But it was also under the reign of Bill Clinton that some of the more onerous anti-terrorism legislation was passed in the mid-1990s. And I remember, in fact, when Bill Clinton was president, the American Civil Liberties Union, which is normally friendly to Democratic presidents, but they came out and said that Bill Clinton had been the worst president for civil liberties since Woodrow Wilson back during World War One. And of course, World War One is when we had the Red Scare, we had the Palmer raids, we had the Wilson administration's repression of the anti-war movement, of the labor movement. That was when the FBI was created under J. Edgar Hoover's leadership. That's when radicals like Emma Goldman were deported from the United States. So the ACLU was basically comparing the administration of President Clinton to the Wilson administration. And I think it was largely correct, at least up to a point. During the Clinton administration, the war on drugs expanded to a war on all sorts of things, like guns, gangs, terrorism, crime, on down the list. And of course, Republicans were always accomplices to this. I don't want to ever sound like I'm letting Republicans off the hook or letting Democrats off the hook. This has been a bipartisan effort for as long as this has been going on. Some of the worst police state legislation has been put through Congress by supposed liberal Democrats. Some of the worst drug law legislation was put into effect largely through the efforts of guys like Joe Biden, Tip O'Neill, who was Mr. Liberal. He was the Speaker of the House for a long time back in the 80s. Ted Kennedy, who was a prominent liberal, one of the
members of the Kennedy family, he wrote a lot of legislation concerning crime that basically abrogated much of the Bill of Rights. So, the growth of the police state has not been some right-wing, conservative, religious right law and order thing all by itself, although that certainly enters into it. The liberal side of the political spectrum has played a big role in this as well. And that's something that's always been always important to remember, particularly when it comes to the war on drugs. The war on drugs has been a bipartisan effort throughout most of its history. Then when we get into the 2000s, of course, September 11th, 2001 comes along and we start seeing the growth of the Bush administration's war on terrorism. And we start seeing the Patriot Act and things like military commissions. And, those of you who follow dissenting politics, those of you who are political radicals of any kind, left or right, are no doubt aware of these things. And that's really how the contemporary police state that we have in America today got put together. It really started in its modern version, without going back to things like the suspension of habeas corpus by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, or the Red Scare during World War One, or the repression of the anti-war movement during World War Two, or the persecution of the ethnic Japanese in World War Two. Even if we just go back to the post-war era, we go back to about 1969, 1970, we go back to the beginning of the war on drugs, we see all of this building up gradually. We see the war on drugs becoming just a general war on everything, and then the war on terrorism. And that is what has created the police state that we have today. Now, when we talk about the modern American police state, and I do believe it is a full-blown police state, I do believe that we now have a legal system, a law enforcement system in the United States that is every bit as authoritarian as what you would find in any traditional third world autocracy. All right. Now, I would qualify that by saying that while our legal system in the United States may well be that comparable to a third world authoritarian regime, it's not necessarily totalitarian yet. It doesn't quite rival what you would have found in the Stalinist countries of Eastern Europe, or the Soviet Union, or Nazi Germany, or contemporary North Korea, or a place like that. Right? There is an important difference between authoritarianism and totalitarianism. Right? Totalitarianism is literally where the state tries to control everything without exception. For example, North Korea is a good example. There, everything is subordinated to the state. There's nothing that the state does not control. In other historic Stalinist regimes, that was the case. In Nazi Germany, that was the case. Most regimes that have existed really throughout most of history, and certainly throughout most of, say, the last century, have been more in the realm of authoritarian than totalitarian. All right, but when I say that we now have an authoritarian legal system in the United States, what do I mean by that? Because some people, for example, would say, well, how is it that you, Keith Preston, are allowed to do things like go on the internet and broadcast these podcasts and write the kinds of things that you write and run websites and other internet forums like you write and say the things that you say if we have an authoritarian system? And that's a very good point. It's one that's well worth considering. But the way that a political authoritarianism works in modern American society is rather interesting, to say the least, and I think historically somewhat unique, in that in a country like the United States, you can pretty much belong to any political party you want. And if you go online and you look up a list of political parties in the United States, you can see there's all kinds of small little fringe parties for all sorts of things. There's still a Prohibition Party. There's the American Nazi Party. There's the American Communist Party and all sorts of other things like that. Right? So you can technically belong to any political group, any religious group. You can pretty much advocate for any political issue that you want. However, it's also true that access to the system is blocked by a system of political control. As anybody that's ever been involved in some of these little third-party political campaigns can tell you, actually trying to get your candidates even on a ballot, even in local elections, even in state elections, forget federal elections, is extremely difficult. Having your candidate included in public debates between candidates, having your candidate even being able to afford any advertising on television or anything like that is extremely difficult. So the American power elite has created a system where they don't, for the most part, have to rely on brute force. That is, they don't have to go out and simply kill people that they consider enemies of the state, because they have a very effective institutional means for excluding enemies from the state from ever gaining access to power through the electoral system, through control of the media, through control of the educational system, where they inculcate the values of the system to each succeeding generation, through the corporate plutocracy, where only those who have the money are going to have access to political power. Right? So the system, the power elite in a country like the United States, and it works in a similar way in other countries and have a similar system, modern liberal capitalist democracy works in such a way that the state, for the most part, does not have to rely on brute repression, and because it has much more efficient and much more subtle systems of control that are much more effective at creating a veneer of legitimacy for the state. For example, in a society like our own, when someone like me criticizes the system and says the system is authoritarian, the system is corrupt, the system is imperialistic, the system is, you know, yada, 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 someone who wants to apologize for the system can come back and say, well, what are you talking about, Preston? I mean, you write books, you have a website, you do internet broadcasts, you go on television, you've done all these things to attack the system. That's what you call all of your projects, attack the system. If we had an authoritarian system, someone like you would be in jail. But it works to the system's advantage to allow enough dissent, in fact, to allow a whole lot of dissent, so long as it is not effective, so long as it does not gain access to power, because then the system can come back with arguments like that, because the system is not relying on brute Stalinist, Nazi, fascist models of repression. Now, what's also interesting is as the state is starting to lose its legitimacy, and we see the state losing its legitimacy in a lot of ways. For example, opinion polls. Opinion polls will show that the approval rating of virtually every single institution in our society is now in the negative, that more people in the United States disapprove of virtually every institution that we have more than they support those institutions, and that Congress is one of the most negatively rated of all institutions. The president typically has a below average approval rating. The legal system has a below average approval rating. The media, the educational system, the foreign policy of the United States, and just about everything else, polls will consistently show that all of these things have a negative image in the eyes of the majority of the American public, which is a long, long ways away from what it was, say, in 1969 and 1970, when those protest movements from that era, from that generation, were in full bloom. Right, back in the era when guys like Richard M. Nixon were laying out the groundwork for the contemporary police state, Back then, most people believed in the system. And even at the height of the Vietnam War, if you said the system sucks and there's something wrong with the system, you know, most people would be inclined to say, oh, no, I believe in my government. I believe in the system. You don't really see many people saying things like that today. I very rarely hear people making comments like that. Maybe it's just the kind of people I associate with. But you know, but even in just normal everyday life, I'm not talking about people who belong to dissident political movements of any kind, whether it's something somewhat middle of the road or something very radical. You know, just in everyday, among everyday non-political people, I hear a lot of criticism, a lot of grumbling about the system that I didn't hear when I was growing up, you know, in Reagan's America of the 1980s or Richard Nixon's America of the 1970s. But we do hear a lot of that today. So the system is losing its legitimacy because we do see the system becoming increasingly unpopular. And that's reflected in things like foreign policy. If September 11th had happened back in the 1950s, the United States would have gone to war with the entire Muslim world. Most people have forgotten about September 11th, just barely a decade after it happened. Ever since the war in Vietnam, and I've talked about this on this program before, but ever since the war in Vietnam, there's really been very little enthusiasm for imperialist war by the American government, which is why all subsequent wars since then have had to be fought with all-volunteer professional armies. The draft has been politically impossible since Vietnam. And even with an all-volunteer professional army, the American public will still not accept casualties beyond a certain level, which is why wars now are fought mostly with technology and air power and things like that. And the public will not accept any sacrifice on their own part for the sake of waging war. They will not accept war taxes. They will not accept rationing. They will not accept the draft, all of which were things that were considered perfectly legitimate and perfectly normal during wartime in past times, like, say, World War II or World War I or something like that. All right, so we see the system losing its legitimacy in that way. Now, I also posted an article by Wendy McElroy on Attack the System fairly recently, probably about a week or so ago. Let's see if I can find that. On November 29th, I posted an article called The Reason Police Brutality is Rising. The Reason Police Brutality is Rising. This is an article by Wendy McElroy. Wendy McElroy is a libertarian writer. She's sort of considers herself a feminist, but she has some very maverick ideas compared to what you often find coming from feminists. But Wendy McElroy has this article called The Reason Police Brutality is Rising. And police brutality clearly is rising. There's no doubt about that. I saw some statistics recently that showed that since September 11th, 5,000 Americans have been killed by the police. 5,000 people have been killed by the police in the last 12 years. So that's a rather extraordinary number. Now we can argue, well, it's not, you know, on the same level as, you know, Stalinist purges. It's not Pol Pot's Cambodia. It's not Idi Amin. But it's still a pretty large number, you know, 5,000 people killed by the cops. And, you know, even if we consider that some of those were likely justifiable homicides, you know, some of them may really have been incidents where violent criminals were threatening innocent people and the police had to take them out for, you know, reasons of public safety. Even if we concede things like that, still 5,000 people killed by the police in the space of 12 years. It's quite a bit. And there's really not a day that goes by, and I've made this point on the program before as well, there's really not a day that goes by where somebody does not send me yet another news report of the police killing an innocent civilian or killing someone under dubious pretenses, or if not murdering someone, beating somebody up, you know, ridiculously, or vandalizing some innocent person's home, or killing an animal, or something like that. I hear reports about this every single day. I get multiple reports of this kind every single day. I have a lot of people who send me this kind of material as it comes up, as these kinds of things get into the news and so forth. And so every single day I come across yet another example of some atrocity committed by the cops. And clearly that kind of thing is rising. As I've said before, one thing that shows how extensive the police state is in the United States today is the fact that these kinds of things are starting to spread into population groups and into social classes and into demographic groups where we did not see it before. Poor black people were always victims of police brutality in American society. Poor rural white people who come into disputes with oppressive mining companies were always victims of police brutality. Migrant workers on plantations were always victims of police brutality. American Indians on reservations were always victims of police brutality. Marginalized population groups were always victims of police brutality. But now we start to see police brutality spilling over into the conventional working classes, into the middle classes, even into affluent sectors, you know, even in the suburbs and so forth. It's starting to affect population groups that we never saw before. And that really is a sign that police brutality has started to explode in recent times. Now, Wendy McElroy, in this article, The Reason Police Brutality is Rising, talks about why that is the case. And her explanation, I think, is as good as any. And her explanation is it's simply because the system is losing its legitimacy. Governments, if they are led by people that have any kind of foresight at all, normally do not want to rule on the basis of just sheer brute force. Now, there are certainly have been governments that have done that, but most political authorities who are concerned about the long-term survival of their regime do not want to rule on the basis of just sheer brutality for its own sake. They instead want the system to have at least a veneer of legitimacy. That is, they want people to actually believe in the system and think the system is a good thing and think the system is on the side of what's good. And they want people to think that the system is led by good guys. That is how virtually all intelligent, sensible, or at least political rulers who are motivated by enlightened self-interest, that's how most political authorities want to rule. They want the people to really believe. That's particularly true in liberal, democratic, capitalist societies. It may be less true in a Stalinist state or a fascist dictatorship or something like that. But certainly in a modern, Western-style, liberal democracy, the power elite in any society wants to create a veneer of legitimacy for itself. It wants the people to believe in them. Right. The fact that police brutality is rising to the degree that it is indicates that the system is losing its legitimacy and that the power elite knows this. And therefore, on the part of authorities, there is less concern about alienating the public through things like police brutality. And that's why police brutality is starting to spread over into a wider variety of population groups. All right? So the police state is growing. Along with that, the prison industrial complex. I gave an interview to Robert Stark on Countercurrents recently where I was talking about that, about how the United States has 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prisoners, about how incarcerating people, mass incarceration is now a big business. There are a lot of private prison companies who make a huge amount of money off of this. And some of this gets pretty scandalous. All right, so that's what's going on as far as the growth of the police state in our society today. We see the growth of the war on drugs. We see the militarization of law enforcement. We see the war on drugs expanded into a general war on all sorts of things. We see the growth in police brutality, the growth of mass incarceration. As far as the legal system itself, this is something that cannot be left out. American political authorities have long prided themselves on having what they consider to be the best legal system in the world. And in American state propaganda, you hear this quite a bit about how great our legal system is, and now I'd argue that in some ways the American legal system is probably not as corrupt as what you might find in some parts of the world. For example, in some parts of the world, it's nothing to simply bribe the judge. If you want to win your case, you just bribe the judge. That's how you do it. That's not as difficult to do in our own system. But when I say that our legal system in the United States is authoritarian, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about arbitrary situations where a judge or a jury or a prosecutor or an attorney or whatever simply throws a case because somebody passed them some money. I mean, that actually happened. That does happen. All right, but that's not necessarily what I'm saying is the norm, and that's not what I'm talking about when I say the legal system is authoritarian. What I mean is that in the American legal system, there is a veneer of civil rights being upheld. For example, it's still the law that the police have to read you your rights when you're arrested. It's still the law that you're supposed to be entitled to a bail hearing within a certain amount of time. I think it's 48 hours. That may vary depending on the crime or the jurisdiction or whatever. But you're entitled to a bail hearing. If you don't have a lawyer of your own, you're entitled to a public defender. You're entitled to an appeals process. So these procedural rights that criminal defendants have are in place. Right. It's not really the same thing as, say, a Stalinist model legal system where if they decide they don't want you around, they just round you up off the street and nobody ever sees you again. All right. So that's not the kind of system we have in the United States, or at least not yet. But when I say that the United States legal system is authoritarian, I mean it's not totalitarian. It's not Stalinism. Right, but it's a system where, yes, you do have a lot of formalized procedural rights, but the substance of those procedural rights is increasingly being hollowed out. For example, under the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, you're supposed to have a wide variety of legal rights. You know, obviously, there's the ones that are the most famous, like the ones in the First Amendment, free speech, freedom of religion, and so forth. But there's also the freedom from excessive punishment in the Eighth Amendment. There's the right to counsel, which I believe is in the Sixth Amendment. There's freedom from self-incrimination, which is in the Fifth Amendment. There's the requirement or the protection against excessive searches and seizures in the Fourth Amendment. It is these legal rights that are increasingly being hollowed out as the police state has grown. And here's an example of how this has happened and how this works. If you go back and look at some of the protest movements of the 1960s and 1970s, and I keep using those as an example, not necessarily to defend those or say those are a model for what we should be doing today. That's a whole separate question. I mean, however we want to assess any of that is a separate issue. But that was really the last time that we had large-scale political dissent and large-scale political activism of a fairly radical nature going on in the United States. And it's interesting to go back and see how the elite, how the state, how the ruling class, how the power elite of that particular time responded to that. If we go back and look at the history of a lot of the different radical groups that existed during that time, groups like the Black Panthers and other Black Power, Black Nationalist type groups, groups like the Students for the Democratic Society, which was a student radical group, Youth International Party, which was a similar group, even groups like the Weathermen and that kind of stuff, as well as other groups that were less extreme than the ones I just mentioned, you see that there was a great deal of effort by the state to infiltrate and disrupt these organizations, and that happened under the COINTELPRO program. And this isn't just speculation. This has all since been documented. There have been people who participated in COINTELPRO who've admitted to it, who've written books about it. It was exposed in congressional hearings in the 1970s. So all of these things really did happen. And one thing that the system did back in those days was that they tried to railroad a whole lot of political dissidents and activists and so forth on conspiracy charges. They would bring all kinds of wild conspiracy charges against radicals for the purpose of putting them on trial, hopefully putting them in jail. And if that didn't work, they would at least distract them from their political work. That is, they would disrupt these movements by putting the leaders on trial and preventing the leaders from at least doing their political work while they were on trial and trying to defend themselves and that kind of thing. This was used as something to obstruct the protest movement. There were about 65 conspiracy trials during the late 60s and early 70s involving radicals of different types. And most of the time, the radicals would win, ultimately. Even if they got convicted in the lower courts, say in the lower level federal courts, like a federal district court or in a state circuit court, a superior court, even then, the case might be overturned on appeal through the federal appeals courts or something like that. For example, the Black Panthers actually won 95% of their actual court cases, even though 28 members of the Black Panthers were actually killed in shootouts with the police. All right. One of the most famous cases was the Chicago 7. I talked about that in one of the podcasts that I did. All right. That case was overturned on appeal. So one thing that happened in the 1970s and 1980s and since then in response to this was that the system has tried to hollow out the procedural rights of legal defendants in such a way as to make those rights meaningless. And I think that to a large degree, this has been done in response to the uprisings of the 60s and 70s and the fact that a lot of people that were attacked by the state through the legal system were able to beat their cases through claiming their rights, through the appeals and things like that. What we've seen in the last few decades is an effort by the system to stack the judiciary with jurists who are rather hostile to civil liberties and constitutional rights. And this is one thing that I agree with the left on. For example, we've heard a lot of rhetoric over the last few decades coming from the mainstream right, the so-called conservative movement. All right, and the conservative movement, the mainstream conservative movement, has never been anything other than the political arm, the grassroots political arm of the right wing of the ruling class, the military-industrial complex, the Sun Belt wing of the ruling class, and so forth. That's a separate issue. I've written about that before, but that's a somewhat separate question. All right, but that's all mainstream conservatism has ever been, ever since the conservative movement, the post-war American conservative movement, was enacted back or put together back in the 1950s. It's always been the political arm of the right wing of the ruling class, the military-industrial complex, and things like that. And one thing you started hearing a lot of this mainstream conservative movement talking about in the 70s and the 80s was activist judges. And even to this day, you still hear them talking a lot about that. Now, sometimes that comes from grassroots conservatives. That is, just ordinary people who vote Republican. And when they criticize activist judges, they're thinking about things like Roe versus Wade or issues, social issues that are of importance to social conservatives. Right. But I think that an unfortunate thing, I mean, those people may be sincere, but I think an unfortunate thing that's come out of that is that a lot of so-called social conservatives, particularly the pro-life movement, have become dupes for a conservative political establishment fact, I don't even know that conservative is the right word. I don't even know that right wing is the right word. But become dupes for a branch of the political establishment that has sought to stack the judiciary with jurists who are hostile to basic constitutional rights under the cover of opposing so-called judicial activism around things like abortion and school prayer and controversial social issues. And I think what the system has really tried to do is stack the judiciary with jurists who are hostile to constitutional rights, particularly when it comes to political cases. And that's what they've largely done. And the effect of that has been to hollow out many of these procedural rights, right, without totally abrogating them, right, without having a Stalinist model police state where if the state doesn't like you, they just round you up off the street. Rather than doing it that way, they've sought to eradicate, retain the formal procedures of constitutional rights by gradually hollowing out their substance. And one of the ways they've obviously done that is with the war on drugs. If you look at many of the different aspects of the war on drugs, you see, for example, that the very concept of innocent until proven guilty has been eradicated through things like asset forfeiture laws. The exemption from cruel and unusual punishment has been eradicated through things like mandatory minimum sentencing. And people in the drug law reform movement can tell you all about this, right? But I'm not really approaching it from that angle as much as I'm talking about how this serves the wider purpose of consolidating the police state. Because I think that's all the drug war is. It's simply a smokescreen for consolidating the police state. I mentioned the book by David Mosteau earlier. There's a couple other books on drug prohibition or on the war on drugs that are well worth reading. One was a book that was published back in the early 70s by Dr. Thomas Zaz. He was a maverick psychologist or psychiatrist. He died, I guess, earlier this year, very recently. He was in his 90s when he died. But Dr. Zaz wrote a book back in the early 70s called Ceremonial Chemistry. And he lays out the cultural essence of what the war on drugs is about, as well as any commentator I've ever come across. And he really complements David Mosteau's work in many ways. And what he says is that the bottom line is the war on drugs is simply a form of cultural persecution. And that is, it's about identifying populations, demographics, subcultures, and so forth that happen to have a particular drug as its cultural drug of choice. You know, within the mainstream middle America culture, the drugs of choice are alcohol, tobacco, caffeine, and some of the pharmaceutically or medically approved stimulants and depressants, Valiums, Prozac and all that kind of stuff. Right? But you know, among other cultures, among ethnic cultures, among youth cultures, among countercultures, among subcultures that are more marginal, that are not part of this middle America culture, you see other drugs that tend to be a drug of choice, things like marijuana, cocaine, heroin, and so forth. And of course, there's overlap. I mean, there's plenty of middle America types who use those drugs as well, at least nowadays, maybe not as much in past times. But what Dr. Zaz argues is that drug prohibition is really just a form of cultural persecution that is comparable to religious or ethnic or political persecution, that when the dominant society of alcohol and tobacco and Prozac users passes laws where they subject users of marijuana and cocaine and LSD to arrest and incarceration, prosecution, execution, or whatever, that's really no different than if Democrats were doing the same thing to Republicans or vice versa, or Protestants to Catholics and vice versa, or white people to black people and vice versa, or Jews to Gentiles and vice versa. All right? It's really just a form of cultural persecution. And beyond that, it serves this wider purpose of strengthening the police state in a much more generalized sense. There's another book written in 1996 by a historian by the name of Richard Lawrence Miller. And his book is called Drug Warriors and Their Prey. Drug Warriors and Their Prey. And the subtitle is From Police Power to Police State. And he outlines very meticulously, with a great deal of detail, how the growth of the war on drugs is in fact a cover for the growth of a police state that approximates that of a totalitarian regime. Maybe not completely so, maybe not absolutely so, maybe not taking it as far as Stalinist Russia or Nazi Germany or Mao's China or Idi Amin's Cambodia, Idi Amin's Uganda or Pol Pot's Cambodia. All right, but certainly headed in that direction, by means of hollowing out traditional constitutional and civil rights. And we see a vast array of examples of that now in the American legal system through drug laws, through many other forms of legislation. It's one thing that I think libertarians get wrong is for many years I've heard libertarians talk about things like victimless crimes, consensual crimes, as if the only real problem with the American legal system is we just need to get rid of some laws. To hear the rhetoric you hear coming from some of those camps, you'd think, well, if we could repeal drug prohibition and consensual crime laws like underage drinking and gambling or prostitution or whatever, then the police state would go away and everything would be okay, because then the police would be limited to enforcing laws against predatory crime like murder and robbery and rape and things like that. And I think, in many ways that's a well-meaning, but I think it's a naive point of view, because the sumptuary laws like the war on drugs are there to serve a wider purpose, and that's hollowing out the substance of due process, the substance of constitutional rights, the substance of civil liberties altogether. And if drug prohibition was somehow miraculously taken out of the hands of these people, well, they would just find something else to attack. They'd build a police state in the name of some holy struggle against environmental contamination or racism, or something that's not politically correct, or some other form of something that's considered immoral, sexual immorality, or something like that. It could come from the left, it could come from the right, but they'd find something. All right. Now, on that note, some of this gets to this question of totalitarian humanism. And of course, as I said, I've written about this quite a bit, spoken about it quite a bit. Totalitarian humanism, the idea that the state tries to control every aspect of life, interfere in every institution in society, and centralize and concentrate its own power to an ever greater degree for the sake of enforcing ostensibly progressive values, waging war on other countries in the name of human rights, concentrating power politically so that, say, local communities don't practice backward social values, or interfering in the autonomy of competing institutions to the state to make sure no one's discriminating against anybody, or no one's being politically incorrect, or no one hurts themselves. Regulating all of our personal lives to make sure we're taking care of our health and things like that. That is what totalitarian humanism is. And it's a very insidious force, and it's something that's grown exponentially in recent decades in the United States and in the rest of the Western world. And that gets to this question of how totalitarian humanism relates to the growth of the police state, drug prohibition, and things like that. I recently saw a debate online between a group of libertarians, and they were arguing about the question of what has done more to strengthen the police state. has traditional forms of outgroup hostility, bigotry, whatever you want to call it, done more to strengthen the police state, or has political correctness done more to strengthen the police state? And of course, different people have different views on that, depending on their own biases and their own personal values and their own interests and so forth. But I think, and really, that's the wrong way to frame the question. It's not appropriate to frame the question in terms of what has done more to strengthen the police state, traditional forms of outgroup hostility or newer forms like PC. Rather, the question is to what degree these forces complement one another in the expansion of the police state. To give an example of that, I recently wrote a piece that was also posted on attackthesystem.com, and then it was reposted on the Libertarian Alliance blog that Dr. Sean Gabb operates. And in this piece, it's called Culture Wars and the Police State. Culture Wars and the Police State. It's a brief blog post on attackthesystem.com dated November 28th, 2013. The context of this is I was responding to the reprint of a book review. Kevin Carson, some years ago, wrote a book review of Dr. Sean Gabb's work, Cultural Revolution, Cultural War, that gets into this question of political correctness and so forth a bit. And in this piece, I outline my own thoughts on this somewhat. And what I'm arguing is that the police state, political correctness, and traditional forms of outgroup hostility, and in present societies, that is, in modern, Western, industrialized, liberal, capitalist, democratic societies, these things are starting to converge with one another and be supportive of one another. And here's an example of how that happens. Or rather, here's a brief overview of how that happens. As I mentioned, in the early 70s, in response to the growth of the protest movements and so forth, the system decided to, the power elite, the political authorities and so forth, decided to go about strengthening the police state under the guise of the war on drugs, under the guise of creating paramilitary police organizations, under the guise of creating plans for martial law, through the process of stacking the judiciary with jurists who are hostile to constitutional rights. Through this, the system has sought to strengthen its own position. And in fact, I think that the system, I think the power elite in this country was to a large degree frightened by the uprisings that they saw 45 years ago in this country. For instance, when General William Westmoreland, who was the commander of the American forces in Vietnam, told Lyndon Johnson that in order to sustain a land war in Vietnam, that he would have to raise an additional 1 million troops. That is, the government would have to draft about 1 million men into the army and send them off into a land war in Vietnam. And this would escalate the Vietnam War way beyond what it ever was. The Vietnam War at its peak had about 500,000 American troops deployed in Vietnam. William Westmoreland told President Lyndon Johnson that he might need 1 million more to sustain a full-blown land war in Vietnam of the type that he wanted. When he made that proposal, J. Edgar Hoover, who was head of the FBI, told President Johnson that he would not be able to sustain he would not be able to guarantee the internal security of the United States if that were to happen. That is, there would be so much opposition to such an extension of the Vietnam War that there would be riots, there would be uprisings in the United States, the American government would be faced with a full-blown insurrection if the government tried to extend the war in Vietnam on that level. That, in fact, was one of the reasons why President Johnson declined to run for re-election in 1968, was because he knew that his Vietnam War policy was a failure, and he came to that conclusion in large part after these conversations with William Westmoreland and J. Edgar Hoover, among other things. And as I explained at the beginning of the program, when his successor, Richard Nixon, came into office, they tried to strengthen the police state. They tried to strengthen the system of provisions for martial law under the cover of things like war on drugs. And that's what the system has been doing ever since. Ever since then, for 40 years plus, the system has been strengthening its own position. The system has been trying to recruit after some of the blows that it took during the uprisings of the 60s and 70s. And the things that I've been talking about this evening during this podcast are examples of that. But what I've been talking about so far involves the stick rather than the carrot. The system at present uses the carrot and the stick as a means of maintaining control. The stick is the things that I've been talking about, the police state, the prison industrial complex, the war on drugs, paramilitary policing, terrorism laws, all of this police state legislation we've seen over the last few decades under the cover of fighting crime and drugs and gangs and all sorts of other things. All right, that's the stick. And what I've discussed in this program is just the surface. I mean, it would take hours, days to discuss all this stuff in detail to really to cover it thoroughly. But there's also a carrot involved in this process. There's also a carrot. And the carrot has been this. Ever since the early 1970s, the system has tried to co-opt dissident political movements in the United States by bringing them into the system as much as possible and giving them as many concessions as they reasonably can, while at the same time upholding their own interests. That is, the system has largely been successful in co-opting the protest movements, the forms of political radicalism that came about in the 40s, I mean in the 60s and 70s, 40 plus years ago, which is the last time there was any genuine upheaval or rebellion in this particular society. The system has been successful in co-opting most of that and incorporating much of it into the system to the point that it's not really against the system anymore. It's just another branch of the system. And that is what political correctness actually is. That's what it comes from. All right. As I've talked about in previous broadcasts, the United States and the Western world generally experienced a very far-reaching cultural revolution, social revolution in the 1960s and the 1970s that has expanded and continued until the present time. There's no doubt about that. If we go back and look at the social and cultural changes that have occurred in the Western world since, say, 1968, almost half a century, 45 years, we see that there has been a very far-reaching, very extensive set of social and cultural changes that can only be described as revolutionary in many different areas of life, many different areas of society. Not just one or two things, but just about everything. It's also been the case that a new class has come to power during that time. And that is the rise of this, what George Orwell started to call the new class back in the 1940s. But it's the ever-expanding, rising upper-middle class of the newly rich, the expanded professional class, the expanded public sector, the expanded managerial sector. We've seen the rise of that class, and we've seen that class continue to grow over the last half century. This rising upper-middle class that's now being incorporated into the state apparatus. All right, I've talked about that in other programs as well. But what's interesting, though, is as this class revolution and as this cultural revolution has happened over the last half century, the power elite proper, that is, the overlords of the military-industrial complex, the state, the corporate plutocracy, the international empire, all these kinds of things have retained power. Right? The plutocracy is still rolling. The empire is still rolling. And the police state has become ever more expansive since that time. Even as all of these cultural values, these dissenting cultural values, these countercultural values, have been incorporated into the system. And now to dissent from many of those values is considered a taboo. And it's something you can lose your job for, or in some countries be put in jail for, and things like that. It's really fascinating to observe how this has happened, how the system has been so effective at co-opting all the cultural movements of the 60s and 70s by incorporating that value system into the wider apparatus of state institutions, all the while and incorporating the social class out of which this movement grew, this cultural movement grew, incorporating that into the system as well, while maintaining this broader apparatus of capitalism and imperialism and the state. And if we don't understand these things, then we cannot understand how contemporary societies work. The system works according to the carrot and the stick. The carrot is all of the progressive social legislation that's been enacted over the last half century. Civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, environmentalism, consumer rights, extended welfare rights, animal rights, you name it. All these kinds of things, to varying degrees, have been brought into the system, and the system has become much more integrated. It's become much more diverse culturally, demographically, ethnically, and so forth. At the same time, as this carrot has been used to co-opt dissident movements from the past, the stick has also been strengthened. The stick of the police state, the stick of the prison industrial complex, the stick of an increasingly authoritarian legal system, all of that has also been strengthened. So out of that now, we have a system that's emerged that on one hand, political correctness and ostensible cultural progressivism has become the legitimating ideology of the state. And on the other hand, the police state, the state's apparatus of repression, has also been strengthened. These two things have converged. Right? And the war on drugs really feeds both ends of that, because on one hand, it's been to a large degree through the cover of the war on drugs that the police state has been consolidated. But you can also incorporate the war on drugs into the ideological framework of progressivism. For instance, you can make the war on drugs not about morality and conservative values like law and order. You can make it about progressive values like health and things like that. And it's not uncommon to see liberals, people with solidly liberal credentials, supporting drug prohibition in the name of health and all sorts of do-gooder sounding ideals. In fact, it's not uncommon to see racial minority civil rights leaders supporting the war on drugs and drug prohibition, even though it's clear that it is the ethnic minority groups who are most negatively impacted by the war on drugs. Even their own ostensible political and religious leaders cannot see this, or if they do, they don't admit it. All right? So things like the war on drugs have emerged as a perfect smokescreen for the expansion of the police state in all these areas and the expansion of the state system of ideological control in a lot of different areas. That's how all these things interact with each other. Unfortunately, most people in radical political camps, left or right, do not understand this. On a daily basis, I have conversations with people. I read the commentary of people who have some ostensibly radical or dissenting political point of view who really have not figured out entirely how this system works, how the police state, how the war on drugs, and how what I call totalitarian humanism intersect with one another. For instance, there are a lot of people out there on the left who understand a lot about how the carrot end of things, I mean, about how the stick end of things works. They understand about how the police state works. They understand how increasingly authoritarian the legal system has come. And if they're more radical, they may even be very critical of the war on drugs. At the same time, when you question political correctness to these people, they look at you like they don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean? Because they have no perception of how pervasive the cultural revolution, the class revolution of the 60s and 70s has been. And they have no perception of how the ideological framework of this kind of cultural progressivism has been incorporated into the state's ideological superstructure. And you see the same thing on the right. You can talk to some conservatives about political correctness, and yeah, they know what you're talking about. They're right on board. But as soon as you start saying, but these things are intertwined with these other things, the political correctness is intertwined with the war on drugs, with the growth of the police state, with the ever-expanding political authoritarianism that we have today, many conventional conservatives have no clue. You know, they still think in this old, you know, 1960s model of police good, you know, law enforcement good, law and order good, you know, military good, war good, the counterculture bad, you know, black people bad, homosexuals bad, that kind of thinking. You still find a lot of people on the rightward end of things who think that way. But the actual paradigm that exists within the context of the system is one where all of this is mutually reinforcing, where political correctness is the ideological smokescreen. It represents the carrot. It's the effort to co-opt protest movements from the past by bringing them into the system, by incorporating them into the system, by incorporating their value systems into the system, by incorporating their thinking into the ideological superstructure of the state, all the while maintaining and expanding this police state as the stick. Right? That is how the system works at present. Right? PC represents the use of the state's carrot because it's used to buy the loyalty of the rising upper middle class, which has largely cosmopolitan values, and to buy the loyalty of the elite and affluent members of the traditional outgroups. That's the first purpose of it. Its other purpose is to obscure real problems associated with things that the left criticizes, like institutional racism and class oppression. Right, while we've seen a very extensive growth of the black middle class since in the post-civil rights era, it's also the case that there's been a very severe system of class stratification among black Americans that has happened, and that the conditions of the poorest blacks have actually gone way down the tubes. Right? And we've seen that on a class-wide basis in general. Class relations in the United States have gone backward very severely in the last few decades. And political correctness is a means of obscuring that. PC is also about exacerbating social conflict between demographic groups by encouraging traditionally dominant or majority groups to view minorities rather than the power elite as the enemy. For example, mainstream conservatives get this wrong all the time. If you talk to them, they still think the real enemy out there is black people, homosexuals, liberals, hippies, you know, whatever, as if any of those are the real source of power in our own society. The real source of power is the overlords of the empire who have created this ideology of political correctness. And lastly, political correctness is used to strengthen the ideological superstructure of the state. The state portrays itself as the good guys because they're out there fighting for all these ostensibly progressive values, or so they claim. They're against racism and sexism and homophobia and all these kinds of things. And they're enlightening society against all these backward influences like religious fundamentalism and racism and sexism and all this kind of stuff. All the while, they're building a police state. They're building a prison industrial complex. They're waging the war on drugs. They're, to a large degree, reimposing segregation through socioeconomic means. They're expanding class oppression. Right? All of these things are intersecting with one another. Until we develop a leadership core for a future resistance movement in this country that understands these issues, we will not be able to effectively combat these issues. As long as the left keeps pointing the finger, saying white people are the problem, men are the problem, Christian people are the problem, evil straight white males are the problem, the middle class is the problem, middle America is the problem, as long as they keep pointing the finger and promoting that kind of demographic conflict, they will get nowhere as far as effectively opposing the system. And the same is true with the right. As long as the right keeps saying black people are the enemy, hippies are the enemy, homosexuals are the enemy, environmentalists are the enemy, liberals are the enemy, that won't get anywhere either. It needs to be recognized that all of these things, PC, like conservatives complain about, the growth of the police state that leftists and libertarians complain about, some populists from the right complain about as well, the ever-growing system of class stratification that people all across the spectrum complain about, all of these things are connected to one another. That is the true form of intersectionality. With that in mind, our task is to build a core, a crop of political leaders, activists, dissidents, thinkers, writers who understand these things and make their audiences understand. We need people who can reach conservatives, people who can reach liberals, libertarians, people all across the spectrum who are not yet aware of some of these problems and are able to make them understand these kinds of problems. And that's why I write about the things that I write about at attackthesystem.com. That's why I've written so much material attacking the police state. That's why I've written so much material attacking the empire. That's why I've written so much material attacking the plutocracy. And all of that kind of stuff would seem to put me on the left end of the spectrum. But it's also why I've written so much material attacking PC and totalitarian humanism, which would seem to put me on the rightward end of the spectrum, because it's not really about that. It's not really about that. It's about the system playing the different ends against everyone else, using PC and a veneer of cultural progressivism as the carrot, using the police state as the stick. Right, that is what we need to be countering. With that in mind, please follow our website, attackthesystem.com, and we update that periodically with new articles, new essays, new podcasts. Also, you can follow our Facebook page, just called Attack the System. We have a Twitter account that's under the name of American Revolutionary Vanguard, which is the political group that sponsors Attack the System. You can also find a lot of material on my personal Facebook page about this kind of stuff as well. And if you wish to support what we do here through things like donations, that's always welcome. We have a donation page on the website, attackthesystem.com. And until then, this is Keith Preston for attackthesystem.com, and have a good week.